we handle those awkward moments when a friend or a boss accuses us of something we didn't do? When our adversary wags a finger of shame in our direction, it's natural to feel incensed, indignant, and to look for colleagues who will take our side. Today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll teaches from John chapter 7, where we see Jesus caught in the crosshairs of his opponents. His response is a model for us all. In the event you missed Friday's program, Chuck begins with helpful review. His message is titled, Jesus in the Lion's Den.
Henrietta Mears used to say, "The world cannot breed a lion that God cannot tame." That's the theme of this morning's message. Remember that throughout what you hear from what I have to say about Jesus in the lion's den. The world cannot breed a lion that God cannot tame. There is no such thing as a creature or a circumstance that cannot be tamed by God. Now, the lions in Jesus' day were not savage beasts that walked on 4 feet. They were people who hated him. They were individuals who gave themselves to one supreme purpose: his assassination. They wanted more than anything to be rid of him. He was a nuisance. He was a pest. And they roared and they screamed. But the remarkable thing is, not until God allowed it did they lay one hand on him. We'll see that several times in the story of John chapter 7, Jesus in the lion's den. Now let's be oriented into the passage with the help of the first couple of verses. To begin with, let's answer the question, where was he at this time? Well, the first verse tells us he was walking in Galilee. You know that Jesus was the man of Galilee. That means he was raised in that area. That was the homeland for Jesus. It was perhaps a familiar and quiet pastoral setting. Maybe he enjoyed a time of release from the press of his ministry while he was in Galilee. Later on in the chapter, he goes to Judea for a very important reason, but we'll be there in a minute. He starts in Galilee, which is northern Palestine. He winds up in Judea, which is the central focus of the chapter, where they came for a feast in the city. Now, why was he in Galilee and not in Judea where the crowd was? Look at the verse. He was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. There was a contract out on his life. The talk of assassination was in the air. Probably none of us in this place has ever known that threatening experience. Thank God. We maybe have lived under trying or stress-ridden circumstances, but we've never been the target of an assassin's bullet. Jesus was. Jesus was so hated by many of his own people that assassination was in the air, a plan was being laid. And it was only a matter of time, they felt, before they could pin him and finish him off. So he stayed in Galilee. That's why he was there. When did this take place? The next verse helps us. It was in the time of the feast of the Jews, the feast of Tabernacles was at hand, we're told. Now, there were 3 major Jewish feasts that occurred annually. In all 3, male Jews within a 20-mile radius of Jerusalem were obligated to attend. First was Passover. Second was Pentecost. Third was Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths. Each feast was a historical reminder of something that their forefathers had experienced and endured, and they were never to forget the events when they originally occurred. And so God established these feasts, or these festivals. Now, this particular feast was Tabernacles, and it was a reminder of the days that the people of the Jews lived in little huts, shanties, lived in the caves and the dens of the earth while they were moving across the wilderness to the land of Canaan. And even though centuries had passed since that first took place, the Jews recognized that historically, year after year after year. Now, it was at this feast time that this particular event occurred. Generally speaking, it was in the last 6 months of Jesus' life. You that make a serious study of the Gospel of John should remember that when you get to chapter 7, you have come to the last phase of his life. Chapter 7 through the end of the book is in the last 6 months of Jesus' life on earth. John devotes a great deal of attention to that fact. Now, in the last 6 months of his life, he lived in the lion's den. Those devoted to his death rose up and laid plans to kill him. Look, for example, at the first pack of lions. The technical word is pride. When lions run in a group, they're called a pride. And I think that is a very fitting title for these lions. The pride of lions he first faced happened to be his own brothers. Verse 3. This is now in Galilee, remember, near home, near Nazareth. His brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea." See, they knew the feast was about to take place. They knew that's where the crowd was. And so with sarcasm they said, "Depart, that your disciples may behold your works which you are doing. Do your tricks down there, Jesus. Pull it off in the lights. Don't hang around this area of Galilee. This is the sticks. Go to where the action is. Go down to Judea." Look at the next verse. "No one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly." You know, it pays to advertise. "Leave this area. These people around here don't amount to much. Why don't you go down where the action is? Go down to the city. Go down to Judea. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." I think they were implying, "Look, Jesus, why don't you trade off with them? You do a few tricks and they'll trade you a kingdom. You think you've got something going for you? Do it where the action is. I'll show you why they did that." Not because they were his brothers. Verse 5 tells us the reason why they said it. They didn't believe in him. There is a book in the New Testament entitled the Book of James. It's written by one of the brothers of Jesus, whose name we just read in Matthew. You know, he didn't even believe. He didn't even give Jesus the time of day until the resurrection. These brothers did not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. So they roared against him with sarcasm. Now look at the answer Jesus gave. It's a gracious answer, and it has been misread by scholars, by thinking people. Verse 6, Jesus said to them, "My time is not yet at hand. Your time is always opportune." Verse 8, "Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not yet fully come." Now you read that verse and you say, well, it's his plan not to go to Judea. He tells them that. And yet, a little later on in this chapter, he goes to Judea. And there are those who say he lied. to his brothers. As a matter of fact, a gal named Debbie, who left the first service this morning, said, "I could have shouted when you made a point of that passage in verses 6 through 8. This past week, a fellow teacher in the same school where I teach cornered me and he said, 'Ah, you're a Christian? Do you know that Jesus lied?' And she said, 'No, I didn't.' He said, 'Look.' And she said, 'He opened up John 7 and showed me verses 6, 7, and 8. He said, "Now, what do you have to say about that?" About that time, she said, "The bell rang, and I was so glad, you know, I didn't have an answer for him." But she says, "I'll tell you later." And she said, "Here, the very answer came this morning. He didn't lie." Schopenhauer, the German philosopher, takes a stab at Jesus. He says, "Jesus Christ did of set purpose utter a falsehood. He told him he wasn't going, and then he went." The answer is found in the original text. This is the only place in the writings of John where the word time, T-I-M-E, is translated from the Greek word which means not the destined hour of God for my death, but the season. It's the word that means the right opportunity. We would say the psychological moment. If you're in sales, you know that there is a moment where you press for that contract, or you push for that name to go on the line. You wait for the moment, and then you make your move. That's what the word kairos means here. All other places, it's the word ora. Very technical word, meaning the destined, unchanged hour of God. Schopenhauer, this teacher, and many others haven't thought about that. And so they misread the statement of Jesus and they say he lied. No, he didn't lie. And John helps us understand he didn't with the use of this word. And so the lions tuck their tail between their legs and make their way down to Judea. Jesus' brothers are gone. Now notice what happened. Verse 10, when his brothers had gone up to the feast, he himself also went up, not publicly, but as it were, in secret. I think rather than to play into their hands and look as though he is playing to the grandstands, he remained obscure. He was in the shadows for a period of time. Now, verse 14 tells us when he openly began to teach. Here he is in Judea. It was now the midst of the feast that Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. So it was on the third or fourth day of this tabernacle festival, in the carnival atmosphere of the city of Jerusalem, that Jesus publicly made himself present. Now that might seem to you to be a very common thing. You might think, well, certainly he would. After all, he was the Messiah. Yes, but don't forget, they were laying for him. Was a courageous act. Let me show you the other two prides of lions. We skip them. Differentiate between the two groups, will you? First, there were the Jewish officials, verse 11. The Jews were seeking him at the feast, saying, "Where is he?" This group happens to be those Pharisees, the scribes, the official men of Jewry. But there's another group, verse 12. There was much grumbling among the multitude concerning him. These are the people of the streets, mainly Jews, some Gentiles. And so they were talking about him, verse 13, but they weren't speaking openly because they were afraid of the Jews. That's why I want you to keep these two groups separate in your mind. The first group represents official Judaism. The second group represents those who were followers, who lived in the city of the Jerusalem and surrounding areas and took their orders from that pocket of official men of Judea. Now, out of fear because of those men, the multitude stayed quiet for a while, but not the Jews. The Jews, verse 15 now, began to marvel, saying, How has this man become learned, having never been educated? If you read that and think through it carefully, you will observe that theirs was a problem of academic snobbery. They saw Jesus teaching in the synagogue, in the temple there, and they looked at him and they thought, where did he get his training? Where was he schooled? William Barclay of Glasgow writes a good word at this point. There was arrogant contempt. What right had this man, quite untrained in the theological schools, to come and lay down the law? Jesus had no cultural background. He had no training in the rabbinic schools and colleges. How had he ever learned to read? Surely no intelligent person was ever going to listen to him. Here is the reaction of academic snobbery. And yet the fact remains that many of the greatest poets, writers, and evangelists have had no technical qualifications at all. Now, that is not for one moment to say that technical qualifications and study and culture and education are to be despised and abandoned. But it is to say that we must have a care. Now listen to this. That we never wave a man away or usher him out and consign him to the company who does not matter because he lacks the technical equipment of the schools. I make a point of that because we are indeed in a day like that. A person is judged not first on the basis of who he is, but on the basis of where he trained. What kind of credentials can be presented in his defense? Nothing wrong with credentials, but something terribly wrong when they don't follow a name, when they precede even a judgment or discernment of his person, or hers, for that matter. Now, Jesus was judged not on the basis of what he said, but the lack of schooling. Where has this fellow gotten his training? What authority does he have to speak? I have observed among those who lay heavy emphasis upon these things that they are easily threatened. Often they struggle. They're often competitive, especially around those who gain a greater hearing than they. That's exactly what happened with the Jews. Look across the page. So many verses in the chapter, we can't cover them all. Let's just follow the theme of the Jews for a moment. Look down, for example, at verse 31. Many of the multitude believed in him, and they were saying, when the Christ shall come, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he? The Pharisees heard the multitude muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to seize him. What a threat. The multitude's going to believe in him. And Jesus said, for a little while longer, I'm with you, and then I will go to him who sent me. Meaning his ascension. He would go back to the Father. You seek me and shall not find me. And where I am, you cannot come. The Jews therefore said to one another, where does this man intend to go, that we shall not find him? He's not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks, is he? He's not going to minister to those that have left Palestine and filtered out into the dispersion. They were bothered that his fame might spread and the Greeks believe and those Hellenistic Jews might believe. And before long, they would submerge into nothingness. It was a threat. But there is no lion that man can breed that God cannot tame. You remember we read that they tried to seize him? But look at verse 30 again. No man laid his hand on him. They roared. They screamed. They shouted indictments, but they could not get a hold of him. By the way, it's a beautiful place to pause and say that's true in every believer's life. Some of you live in the fear of what you could call accidental circumstances. For example, there are some who will not fly for fear of mechanical failure and a crash. There are some who will not engage themselves in a certain occupation for fear that sure as the world, it's with my luck, quote unquote, that'll be the last job I'll ever hold. Fear of an accident. Let me tell you something. The days that were ordained for you have been set out by God. There is no accidental death. Now, that's a hard pill for some to swallow. I find great comfort in the sovereign hand of God. Jesus stood up in the midst of that temple and declared the truth of God, and these assassins, as it were, hanging in the background wanting to kill him, could not even lay hands on him until it was God's time. Please forever be released from the fears of the future, especially as it relates to death. He knows what he's doing. I love the poem that is recorded in J. Oswald Sanders' book, Spiritual Leadership. It begins something like, when God wants to thrill a man and skill a man and drill a man, when God wants to work in a man's life, the thought is, when he works on our lives, he ruthlessly perfects those whom he royally elects. How he bends but never breaks those whose good he undertakes. God knows what he's about. That's true in your life. Surrounded by the lions, I want to assure you, God knows what he's about. Just as the Jews of the nation couldn't seize him, they cannot seize you till God gives that okay. Now, if it were just the Jews, it would be one thing, but there was another group, the multitude. Look back at verse 12. They were grumbling. They were saying, and now look at the various opinions. Look at them. First, some said, he's a good man. Others said, he's a controversial person. He leads the multitude astray. Verse 20. Another group said, you have a demon who seeks to kill you. You're paranoid. Why, some said he's a good man. Others said he's controversial. And some said, why, he's demented. He's out of his mind. He's talking about people wanting to kill him. I don't see anybody wanting to kill him. He has a demon. And then there was a group, you'll notice in verse 26, who felt he was very courageous. Look, the group said, he's speaking publicly. And they're saying nothing to him. Takes a lot of courage, and so there was sort of a humanistic respect for him. But I'm pleased to say verse 31 assures us there were some who believed in him. Here was Jesus presenting himself, and some believed. Verse 40, some of the multitude, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, this certainly is the prophet. They said, he's deserving of our faith. Many of the lions roared, but you know, God tamed everyone so that they couldn't attack, and even brought some of them into the family of God.
Teaching from John chapter 7, Chuck Swindoll gave a creative title to his message today, Jesus in the Lion's Den. And in the event you'd like to purchase the complete sermon or the entire collection of studies in John, you can do so online at insightworld.org/store. Chuck's messages are available on CD or downloadable audio files. You're listening to Insight for Living, and rather than move ahead with ministry information as we normally do at this time, Chuck has asked to set everything else aside so he can share an urgent message with you. Chuck, go right ahead.
Thanks, Dave. Whenever I come to a place in my life when I feel stuck, there's only one thing I know to do, and that's to call out for help. My friend, today is one of those occasions. Insight for Living Ministries is facing an urgent need for financial support. And since you're one of our valued listeners, it would be a disservice to tell you anything other than the unfiltered truth. Simply stated, we are stuck. While the ministry impact is vibrant and certainly alive, and while we're reaching more people than ever before, income from our audience is down dramatically. This shortfall has placed us in a precarious position. As responsible stewards, we've aggressively trimmed expenses, curtailed some of our ministry plans, and over this last year, our staff has taken reductions in their compensation. Even so, radio costs and shipping expenses have skyrocketed, especially over the last 10 years, placing our ministry in an untenable position. So, what's the solution? Well, I'm asking you to do two things. First, would you pray about how the Lord wants to use you to help us meet this challenge? And second, however He leads, will you obey? I'm confident that when hundreds, even thousands of you give what God places on your hearts, we can close this gap. Can I count on you? I believe I can. Here's the number to call, 1-800-772-8888. Or you can give online at insight.org.
All right, thanks, Chuck. And if you're listening in the United States, you can also respond by calling 1-800-772-8888. You can also give online at insight.org. I'm Dave Spiker. Be sure to join us Tuesday when Chuck Swindoll continues our study about Jesus in the Lion's Den, right here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Jesus in the Lion's Den, was copyrighted in 1975, 1987, 2000, and 2018. And the sound recording was copyrighted in 2018 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.